Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how much does biology contribute to violent behaviors? We'll explore the anatomy of violence. Then, as California prisoners are on massive hunger strikes, we explore the effects of prison conditions on both the inmates and the guards and the alternatives to the current punishment regime. How much does biology affect propensity for violence? Our next guest argues that people who are prone to kill share common brain patterns, mainly abnormalities in parts of the brains. Adrian Raine joins us. Adrian Raine is professor of criminology, psychiatry, and psychology at the University of Pennsylvania and the author of The Anatomy of Violence, The Biological Roots of Crime. Welcome, Adrian Raine. Great to have you with us.
Nice to be with you.
One of the things I thought was interesting as a social scientist to begin with is how 15 years ago you had proposed this book, but only now has it become something that publishers wanted to publish.
Yes.
That in and of itself says what has changed in social science.
You're right. There has been a sea change, I think, that has occurred in the mindsets of not just the scientific community, but I think also the public too, which has opened the door to a new biological perspective on the causes of violence and crime. 15 years ago, it was anathema almost to be talking about genes, brain functioning as a part basis to violence. But I think that with the, Human Genome Project and really the technical advances of structural and functional brain imaging, which means now that you can't open a newspaper without reading something about brain mechanisms underlying why we buy certain things. We hear concepts of neural law and neuroeconomics. So now it's time for neurocriminology.
So now you've looked at criminology from the perspective of primarily the brain, but also genetics, the heart function, all kinds of things like
Indeed.
This together. As you say, these things are very complicated.
Yes, there's no question.
You actually opened it with a very nice vignette about your own reaction, how you teach your students how to respond to a criminal intrusion, and yet you yourself didn't respond that way when faced with an intrusion.
Yeah, that's right. I do start The Anatomy of Violence by talking about a moment in time where, my instinctive reaction just overrode my common sense. I used to tell students, if you ever had a burglar enter your bedroom late at night, just pretend to be asleep. They'll get what they want 90% of the time. They don't really want any trouble most times. Let them get away, then call 911, and you've got a reasonable chance of getting your stuff back without being harmed. So what do I do at 3 o'clock in the morning when I'm on holiday in Turkey and I become aware of a man standing above my bed? Well, it's my amygdala that just gives a quick defensive response, and I leap out of the bed and I grab hold of him, almost without knowing what I'm doing. And so, yes, at some level, our instinctive brain can take over and make us launch into defensive aggression.
There are parts of the brain that you talk about throughout the book, the amygdala, the frontal cortex. Maybe we should start with how do they
Yes.
work together and how do they interact with these kinds of bodily reactions?
In a way, just as there's different parts of the brain, there's really different causes of violence and crime. And there's not one part of the brain by itself that's going to solve, why some people commit crime and violence. But nevertheless, there are some areas which are quite well researched now, where knowledge is building up, saying, the brains of violent offenders are simply different to the rest of us. One example is the prefrontal cortex. We did a brain imaging study of 41 murderers, and we compared them to 41 normal people who had not committed violence. And what we found is that the murderers as a group had much poorer functioning of the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that sits above your eyes and lies behind your forehead. So, why would this predispose somebody to become violent? Well, the prefrontal cortex is involved in checking on our impulsive behavior. When we feel like doing something impulsively, frontal cortex says, wait, hold on a bit, count to 10. It also regulates emotion. So, we all get angry at times. What stops us lashing out? It's the prefrontal cortex that controls our runaway emotions. So this part of the brain is a bit like the guardian angel on behavior. And in murderers, if that guardian angel is asleep, the devil can come out and commit violence and crime.
So the normal brain looks like what compared to the murderer's brain in that prefrontal cortex?
In terms of functional imaging, it'll show much more activity in the frontal region of the brain compared to the murderer's. Our brain scans were positron emission tomography. So these are color-coded pictures where red and yellow indicate high glucose metabolism, and the cool colors, blue and green, indicate lower glucose metabolism. So, you know, that's instructive in a way, you know, because, you know, it's only recently that we've really been able to look inside the minds of murderers. We can literally see what is going on, and that's a new neuroscientific revolution in terms of brain mechanisms and mind, which is really today revealing a lot about the biological basis of violence.
Now, you also noted that the brains of some types of murderers are different from others. So there's the impulsive, then there's the serial killer, the psychopath.
Yeah.
And they're completely different kinds of activities in different parts of brains.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that they are different. Murderers are not the same. So, you know, some people commit murder on an impulse. There's a lot of emotion surrounding it. It's especially those murderers who have poor frontal lobe functioning. They don't have the ability to check their impulsive behavior and regulate their anger. But there are other killers who are serial killers. One of the murderers in our study was a serial killer who killed 64 people in a 12-year period and was very unlucky to be caught. I mean, he was just doing an illegal lane change late one night on the freeway, and the California Highway Patrol pulled him over, and they only became suspicious when they found a dead body in the passenger seat. I mean, otherwise, this man might still be killing today. You look at his brain functioning, and it's really very different to the other murderers. This man actually had very good functioning in the prefrontal cortex, and I think it's the exception that proves the rule. Because here we have a man who could carefully plan and regulate his behavior without being caught. You know, he could kill his victim, he'd clean up the mess, he'd make sure no fingerprints are left, and then get into work a few hours later as a computer consultant. And you've got to have something good going for you to be able to kill 64 people without being caught. And what he had good going for him was a good frontal cortex that allowed him to plan, regulate, and control. So it's not one size fits all. That's an important caveat here. It's not that all murderers have poor frontal lobe functioning. So we get to the question of, well, what about psychopathic serial killers? I mean, what's going on with them? We've been doing research on psychopaths, and one striking finding we find is that they have an abnormality in the emotional part of the brain called the amygdala. The amygdala is really the seat of emotion. It's what makes us feel empathic for other people. It's a source of remorse, guilt, conscience, moral decision-making. The amygdala is involved in all of these emotions and feelings like fear. Well, with psychopaths, these are people who lack fear. They lack conscience. They lack remorse. They lack guilt. That's why they do the terrible things that they do. Why are they doing it? In part, our research and that of other researchers is increasingly documenting that it's because the amygdala, the emotion region of the brain, is structurally impaired. In particular, there's an 18% volume reduction in the size of the amygdala. So the brains of psychopaths are physically different to the rest of us.
When you looked beyond the serial killer and looked at some societies where there was incredible amount of spousal abuse, for example,
yes,
you also found that there was difference in the brains.
That's right. So let's take spouse abusers. We brain scanned spouse abusers in Hong Kong. And what we did is we presented them with emotionally provocative stimuli. And in normal individuals, these stimuli lead to a large response from the amygdala because, you know, when you're emotionally provoked, your amygdala lights up. Well, that's true in the normal controls, but when we looked at the spouse abusers, we found an even greater response from the emotional amygdala to these mildly provocative emotional stimuli, like emotional words or emotional pictures. And also, we found that the frontal region of the brain was functioning significantly less in the spouse abusers when they were confronted with these stimuli. So what's going on here, and how might it explain spouse abuse? Well, you know, in the home, it may be that if the spouse abuser has an overreactive brain to mildly provocative stimuli, then when that spouse abuser has their spouse criticize them, you know, being a couch potato, sitting around, doing nothing, not doing enough to help, they may overreact emotionally because of that heightened amygdala activation, and yet they do not have the prefrontal regulatory resources to be able to control their impulsive lashing out at their spouse and to control their head trigger tempers. So it gives us a new perspective, in a way, on spouse abuse. Now, I'm not saying that we should excuse spouse abuse. It's a terrible act. Of course, you know, the brain difference in spouse abusers shouldn't be an excusing factor for them. But nevertheless, we could take this knowledge into account in developing new programs for spouse abusers in order to reduce these terrible domestic violence acts.
Before we go into some of the other genetic issues that you wrote about, let's talk also about people who lie and the brain activity that goes on with people who lie or people who tell the truth. What is the difference and what do we conclude?
You know, lying is actually quite difficult. I mean, when you ask people to tell the truth to basic questions, actually, there's not much functioning in the frontal region of the brain. Why is that? It's because telling the truth is very easy. But ask somebody to lie about themselves, and what we see is a lot of activity in the frontal region of the brain. And that's because lying is an executive function. It requires planning. It requires mental resources. If I'm lying to you, I've got to think, well, what does she know and what doesn't she know? And what will she be persuaded by? And also, when you lie, you want to look calm and collected. So you want to suppress your emotions. So the prefrontal cortex has to work on making sure, you know, you don't look anxious or nervous. Also, when people lie, they suppress their motor activity. They don't want to look anxious by moving around too much. So again, the frontal cortex is involved in controlling motor activity. Overall, then, when you lie, you have a lot of frontal lobe activity going on because lying is not easy. It requires executive functions. What we find in pathological liars who con, manipulate, and cheat on a daily basis is that actually they have a very good prefrontal infrastructure. That part of the brain is very well developed. In fact, they have excessive white matter in the prefrontal cortex. White matter are like telephone wires that allow different parts of the brain to communicate, allowing the prefrontal cortex to inhibit the emotional amygdala, for example. So we think that this excessive white matter in pathological liars has developmentally given them a sort of leg up on the rest of us in the ability to lie and cheat.
And so you've talked about a few aspects of the brain, like the frontal cortex, the amygdala, but there are all these other parts you've talked about in the book, the hippocampus, the angular gyrus.
Yep.
What are these?
What's going on here? Yeah, I mean, let's take the angular gyrus, for example. That part of the brain was significantly reduced in functioning in the murderers. The polar prefrontal cortex is also the very frontal part of the frontal cortex. You know, right where your forehead is. Well, what do these parts of the brain do, the angular gyrus and the polar prefrontal cortex, and again, going back to that amygdala, they make up a brain circuit that is very much activated when we contemplate making a moral decision. So in a brain scanner, you can put normal people there, and you give them moral dilemmas, like, you know, would you kill one person to save five lives? So when normal people are contemplating these moral dilemmas, this moral decision-making circuit is highly activated, the angular gyrus, the amygdala, the polar prefrontal cortex. But when we brain scan psychopaths and give them the same moral dilemmas, that emotional circuit is much reduced in its activation. The amygdala is much reduced in its activation. So psychopaths, of course, at a cognitive level, they know right from wrong. But do they have the feeling for what is right and wrong? And I believe it's feeling, it's emotion, which is the engine that drives moral decision-making and moral behavior. If you don't have the feeling for what's wrong, then you're more likely to break the moral rules of society. So then we get to a legal conundrum here. If emotion is the engine that drives moral decision-making, and that's in part the amygdala, and if that's burnt out in psychopaths, then how moral is it of us to punish psychopaths as much as we do?
The hippocampus you wrote about, which you said was the center of learning, mm-hmm. fear conditioning, and regulates that emotion.
Yes. And again, we find, you know, structural abnormalities in that hippocampus. And actually, you know, it's worth bearing in mind here that it's not just a genetic basis to the brain impairments that we see in these offenders, but also the environment can also play a critical role. So, for example, when a stressful environment actually can damage the hippocampus. So when you get very stressed, you get an excessive release of cortisol. That's a hormone which feeds back to the hippocampus, and excessive cortisol is neurotoxic to the hippocampus, meaning it kills off the brain cells within the hippocampus. So like, you know, Vietnam War veterans, for example, who went through chronic stress during the war, they are found to have smaller hippocampi. That part of the brain that's involved in part in regulating aggression and very much important in learning and memory, well, you know, that can be impaired in offenders. And maybe part of the reason for that is because of the usually the negative early home environments that violent offenders are brought up in. So although in Anatomy of Violence, I'm focusing a lot on the brain, biology, and genes, we mustn't forget the critical importance also of the environment. One of the messages, in fact, I want to give is that the social environment itself can be causing the brain impairments that we find to predispose to violent behavior.
Sometimes it can be inherited. You talked in the early part of the book about how certain serial killers, despite their upbringing, were offspring of other serial killers.
Yes, I mean, you know, there are fascinating adoption studies where babies are adopted away from their parents, you know, and adopted into good homes. Now, some of the adopted babies come from homes where one of the biological parents was criminal. And other babies are adopted away into homes, and their biological parents were not criminal. What's fascinating to me from these adoption studies is that the babies who have a biological parent who was criminal, they are much more likely to commit crime than those babies who, you know, are adopted into the same type of, you know, adoptive family environments, but they did not have that biological heritage for crime and antisocial behavior. And that really documents in part that there is a genetic basis to antisocial and criminal behavior. And there are about 200 twin studies now, which are really documenting, not just in children, also adolescents and adults, that aggression and violence has a genetic basis. How much is genetic? How much is environment? It's about 50-50. So about 50% of the variation in crime and aggression can be chalked up to genetic influences. I mean, that also means that half of it can be, you know, attributed to the environment. But the important thing is that until really recently, we've never really acknowledged the biological and genetic basis to crime and violence.
You're listening to The Scholar's Circle. I'm Maria Armudin, and we're speaking with Adrian Rain about his new book, The Anatomy of Violence, The Biological Roots of Crime. Now, you talked also about some of the studies that pointed out particular genes that may give somebody a predisposition towards violence. One was called the MAOA gene.
Yes, indeed. And this is an enzyme that regulates neurotransmitter functioning, and that affects brain functioning. So, you know, Terry Moffitt, Avshalom Kaspi at Duke University, they did a groundbreaking study where they documented in a large community sample of over 1,000 people that those with the genotype that confers low levels of monoamine oxidase A, when it's combined with coming from a home background characterized by child abuse, that's especially when you get adult antisocial behavior. And quite a number of other studies have also replicated and extended that finding. And that's unusual in the field of molecular genetics to get this replication. So they're really onto something there and really showing to all of us that, you know, it's not just genes, it's not just the environment, but it's a critical combination of both of these things coming together to shape the criminal offender.
There were so many fascinating aspects that you put together in this book, Adrian Raine. Also, this condition where some men have an extra aggressive chromosome, the XYY.
The XYY, actually, yes. You know, that's always been a study which has stirred up an awful lot of heat and controversy. Ultimately, one of the strongest studies showed that, yes, XYY are actually more likely to commit crime, but not necessarily more violent. But there's been a recent study with XYY children showing that those children are actually more likely to show aggressive behavior. You know, we have to be careful how far we go with the XYY syndrome here, but it's certainly linked to antisocial behavior. And in children, more recently, it's been linked to aggressive behavior. It's just, you know, another one of these studies that shows, you know, there is in part a genetic basis to crime. But it's not just based on XYY. There's also twin studies, adoption studies, and molecular genetic studies, all of which combined together really tell us, you know, we can't go on saying nothing's wrong with the offender at the biological and genetic level. There is something profoundly going wrong. It's obviously more than biology and genetics, but biology is definitely half of the equation here.
Did you find that it was across the board? I think you did, 41 brain scans?
Yes, what we did is, in terms of the murderers, for example, that's where we had 41 murderers and 41 controls. As a group, we find they have poorer frontal lobe functioning. But here's an important caveat. Not every murder has that poor frontal lobe functioning. I mean, there's variation. I mean, you can take me, for example. I mean, I had a brain scan that looked very much like the serial killer. I mean, what do I make of that? Well, what I make of that is that brain imaging is not diagnostic. It cannot be used, certainly at the present time, to say who's a killer, who's a normal person, who's a serial killer. Clearly, there are normal people like myself with abnormal brain scans, and conversely, there are abnormal people, murderers and psychopaths, with quite normal brain scans. In their case, it may be more the environment causing their behavior. There are individual differences. It's not one size fits all. But nevertheless, we are getting important clues now about what brain areas, when dysfunctional, can predispose or raise the odds that someone will become violent.
You have a whole chapter called The Recipe for Violence, which is this combination that also includes things like metals, malnutrition.
Mm-hmm. It's a whole mixture of things that go to make the violent offender. One of the points I want to make in the anatomy of violence is that clearly there's not one cause. To me, the violent offender is like a, you know, 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle. And, you know, for the past 100 years, we've been carefully turning over the social pieces of the jigsaw puzzle. Things like, you know, poor homes and bad neighborhoods and bad parenting, racial discrimination. And don't get me wrong, those are important pieces. They are important pieces of the jigsaw puzzle. But over the past 2 decades, what we've been doing now is turning over the biological pieces. High testosterone, low resting heart rate, specific genes, poor frontal lobe functioning, amygdala impairments, and so on, which are important pieces too.
Let's go to that. I thought that resting heart rate piece was quite fascinating. How does that play a role?
You know, low resting heart rate to date is the best replicated biological correlate of antisocial and aggressive behavior in children and adolescents, and it also predicts, to some degree, to later violent offending in adulthood. Why would that be? Well, you've got to remember, when you bring somebody into a lab and measure their resting heart rate, they're in the new surroundings, new people, electrodes are being put on them. It's slightly stressful. So when you get stressed and a bit anxious, your heart rate goes up. Now, there are individual differences. You know, resting heart rate is a bit like height and weight. We all vary. Those people with low heart rates in that situation, they are, relatively speaking, lacking in fear. They don't have that normal anticipatory fear that the rest of us have when we're in one of these type of awkward testing situations. So if you have low heart rate, that indicates you've got a lack of fear. Why would a lack of fear predispose you to aggression and crime? Well, it's because if you are not frightened about the potential punishment, you don't mind robbing 7-Eleven. Because you're not concerned. You're not frightened about what can happen to you if you get caught. You know, a kid stealing sweets from another kid, if he's fearless, he's not bothered about, you know, getting caught and about the potential consequences of his behavior. So low heart rate is a sort of risk factor for antisocial behavior because it reflects a lack of fear.
Can this kind of thing be reversed?
Biology is not destiny. We can change the biological risk factors for antisocial behavior. You know, there are over 45 randomized controlled trials that document that medications are actually very effective in reducing impulsive aggressive behavior, whether we're talking about stimulants or antidepressants or antipsychotic medications. They all work. Now, no parent wants to put their child onto medications, but when all else fails, you know, why not give it a try to at least calm the child down and then try them out in other psychological and behavioral programs that might help them? But we don't need to necessarily resolve to medications. Randomized controlled trials are beginning to show that fish oil may be effective in reducing serious offending in prisoners. Two randomized controlled trials from England and the Netherlands are documenting that it reduces serious offending. Why would that be? Fish oil contains omega-3. Omega-3 is a long-chain fatty acid that's critical for brain structure and function. So it's enhancing the brain. And in a way, one message from the anatomy of violence is, if you have a bad brain, that results in bad behavior. So the logic is that if we can improve the brain, we could improve behavior and reduce criminal and violent offending. So that's just one of a number of benign biosocial intervention programs, better nutrition and specifically omega-3, which might just be helpful in the future. Of course, we need more research.
Of course, we always do. Well, Adrian Raine, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
Adrian Raine is professor of criminology, psychiatry, and psychology at the University of Pennsylvania and the author of The Anatomy of Violence, The Biological Roots of Crime. When we come back, the impact of prison conditions on inmates, the guards, and society itself. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Last week, more than 12,000 California prison inmates went on a hunger strike, refusing to eat as a protest against prison conditions, among them solitary confinement. More than 1,000 also did not report to either class or their jobs as part of their action. Scholars and international experts have argued that solitary confinement amounts to torture and should be banned as a means of punishment. Still, in the U.S., hundreds are subjected to the treatment for more than 10 years, according to Amnesty International. What are the impacts of harsh prison conditions, both on inmates and on the guards? What are the alternatives to the current punishment regime? Three experts join us. Hope Metcalf is the Associate Research Scholar in Law and Director of the Arthur Lyman Public Interest Program. She teaches a clinic on prisoners' rights in the United States and is co-author of the reports Administrative Segregation, Degrees of Isolation and Incarceration, A National Overview of State and Federal Correctional Policies, and Gideon at Guantanamo, Democratic and Despotic Detention. Philip Zimbardo is Professor Emeritus of Psychology at Stanford University and currently on the core faculty of Palo Alto University. He has authored more than 50 books, including The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil, Psychology in Life, and The Psychology of Attitude Change and Social Influence. Stuart Grassian also joins us. He is a psychiatrist and a former faculty member at Harvard Medical School. He is the author of Psychiatric Effects of Solitary Confinement and the Effects of Sensory Deprivation in Psychiatric Seclusion and Solitary Confinement. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. Philip Zimbardo, I'd like to start with you. There's a piece that you have written where you summarize what you have found in the Stanford prison experiments and the work that you've done around this. And you've said prisons are places that demean humanity, destroy the nobility of human nature, and bring out the worst in social relations among people. You go on to talk about how they're just as bad for the guards as they are for the prisoners and for society, and that there's really nothing worse. What is it that has led you to conclude that they are this bad?
I'm not really an expert on prisons. I created a mock prison at Stanford back in 1971. But even in that little setting, it was clear that in this mock prison, the essentials of prisons are about power, where guards constantly have to affirm that they have total power and prisoners have none. And they do this by creating an arbitrary, hostile, brutal environment that the prisoners have to adapt to or break down. And that's what we saw in our study, that normal, healthy college students, within a matter of days, were having emotional breakdowns because of the brutality of the guards. And our system was modeled after American prison systems. It was nowhere near as extreme as real prisons. I visited San Quentin's Maximum Adjustment Center some years ago as part of a lawsuit contending that maximum adjustment, which is a euphemism for solitary confinement, was cruel and unusual punishment. And at that time, Federal Judge Zerpley approved, saying that it is amounts to cruel and unusual punishment. It has to be changed. But the changes they put in place were cosmetic, and they've gotten much worse since then. I've met with people who have come out of literally months of solitary confinement. I've met with people who've come out of years of being incarcerated. The young man who was my consultant in the prison study, Carlo Prescott, brilliant young man, was clear that he was permanently ruined by his experience. He came out filled with rage, filled with anger that could never be fully expressed. The other thing is prisons teach people how to be criminals. We know that 60 to 70% of all prisoners are recidivists, meaning within 3 years they go back. And what I discovered, looking at the statistics, in a quarter of the cases, the crime they go back for a second time, a third time, is significantly worse, significantly more serious than the first one. So they are learning not how to be rehabilitated, not learning how to readjust to society. They are learning how to be hardened criminals. So the last thing I want to point out is that the National Academy of Sciences have recently created a work group on over-incarceration in the United States, trying to understand why more than 2 million Americans are in the prison system, more than or maybe twice as much as any country in the world. And, of course, in Michelle Alexander's book, New Jim Crow, she talks about mass incarceration in the age of colorblindness, that is, a disproportional number of the people who are in prison are Black, minorities, Hispanic. And in that sense, have really destroyed many Black communities. Most of African Americans in prison are there for drug-related charges. So the situation is terrible. And the last thing I want to mention is because prisons are a multi-billion dollar industry, the budgets in many states are higher than the budget for university education, but each state says they're broke. So now we are privatizing prisons. We're turning them over to private for-profit agencies. And if it's for-profit, they could care less about rehabilitation. In fact, any expenses that are drain on profits will go out the window, like exercise, like rehabilitation programs, and so forth, even like classes. So for me, the situation in 1971 was terrible, and now it's significantly worse. For me, it's very personally depressing.
Before we move on and talk more specifically about some of these conditions, I just wanted to revisit your primary finding about your simulated prison at the Stanford Prison Experiment, which was that perfectly healthy people became their roles. Can you just briefly talk about that phenomenon? Maybe it'll help people to better understand things that happen in real prisons. Yours, I think, lasted 6 days.
Right. Yeah. The study I conducted, it's presented in full depth for 10 chapters worth in my book, The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Go Bad, Do Bad. In our study, we created a mock prison in which we had 24 normal, healthy, young college students from around the country that we had given personality tests, clinical interviews, and we picked only those who were most normal, healthy. So these are the best and brightest of students in 1971. And these, again, are at 71, these are anti-war activists. These are civil rights activists. These are hippie kids. And we randomly assign them to prisoners and guards. So there's no reason why somebody should be a prisoner, somebody should be a guard. And they all knew that. They knew it was an experiment. Within a day and a half, it stopped being an experiment in their mind, became a psychological prison run by psychologists. And no one ever used the word experiment. If they wanted to get out, they don't say, I quit the experiment. They say, I want to be paroled, and we would have a parole board. But what happened very quickly, within 36 hours, people became their role. You put on the uniform of a guard and the symbols of power, the billy club, the whistle, the handcuffs, the silver-reflecting sunglasses, and you become a guard when you step out on the yard. You're forced to wear the demeaning uniform of a prisoner. In our case, we also had a chain on their foot to remind them, even when they were sleeping, that they were imprisoned. And you become a prisoner. Prisoners rebelled, as they always do, but they got crushed in the end. Within 36 hours, the first prisoner had an emotional breakdown, had to be released, and he became a model of how you get out of this nightmare that they thought was going to be kind of fun and games, playing like cops and robbers. And each day thereafter, for the next 5 days, another prisoner had an emotional breakdown. So we ended the study after 6 days, although we had originally intended for it to last for 2 weeks. And I'm sorry that it went even that long.
Stuart Grassian, let's bring you in. You've looked considerably at solitary confinement, both the history and the effects of it. Now, it was created for a specific reason, but then evolved into something else. What do we need to understand about how solitary confinement developed and its effects?
Well, its history is really very fascinating because the United States was actually the leading country in bringing solitary confinement to the fore back in the very early part of the 19th century. And ironically, it was introduced by the Quakers initially. It was thought that if you could take people away from the evils of modern society and the city life and bring them in touch with themselves, with God, with work, and their own true natures, they would naturally heal. So the idea was get them away from everyone else who was an evil influence, and that meant solitary confinement. And that institution was, we were very proud of it back then, and it was widely studied, emulated. All the great visitors from Europe came and looked at the penitentiaries. Many brought them back for emulation, and lo and behold, it was an absolute disaster. People were becoming psychotic, people were dying, people were suiciding. And, of course, eventually it fell into disfavor, so much so that there's a striking case. In 1890, the United States Supreme Court looked at a case involving a man who had murdered his wife and was duly tried and convicted and sentenced to death on the gallows. But the law had changed so that under the new law, he would first be housed in solitary confinement for somewhere around 1 month. And then he would be hung, as opposed to staying in the county jail. This was now the new Colorado State Penitentiary. Well, his lawyers argued that this additional punishment of 1 month of solitary confinement was so egregious that you couldn't possibly sentence them under this new law. And they also pointed out that the old law was rescinded at the time of the passing of the new, and had the nerve to say, well, then you have to release him. Well, the Supreme Court looked at this. They recognized and acknowledged that solitary confinement causes severe psychiatric harm, insanity, suicide, and that those who survived the ordeal better were not generally reformed and often incapable of readjusting to the larger community and being, as they said, of any subsequent service to the community. The United States Supreme Court in 1890 ordered that this man be released. The order was to the warden of the Colorado State Penitentiary, ordering that he escort Mr. Medley to the gates and let him go free. Mr. Medley got away with murder as a result of this change that would add 30 days about of solitary confinement to a sentence of death on the gallows. And as I always point out, at this point, we have come a long way downhill from there. This idea that solitary confinement is not toxic to mental functioning has no basis in reality, no basis in any medical literature, and there's a lot of medical literature in the other direction. In fact, the issue of the effects of solitary confinement has been of major concern to the United States. Folks remember their history. The Korean War led to concerns about brainwashing of American prisoners of war and a concern about the KGB using these kind of techniques to brainwash people. Well, as a result, there was actually an enormous body of research that was done about the effects of solitary confinement. And lo and behold, this research was funded by the U.S. CIA and the Canadian Department of Defense. It was about 19 years of research on it at Harvard and McGill universities. So I just want to close with saying, we know that solitary confinement is toxic to mental functioning. There is really no question about that. And yet that fact is systematically ignored by folks who want to continue to use that practice.
Hope Metcalf, let's bring you in too. You have looked at the more modern practice of it throughout the states and the federal government. What have your findings been?
Well, before I get to that, I just want to pick up on one thing that Dr. Grassian was saying to really echo that. The present incarnation of solitary confinement as we see it in many prisons across the U.S. not only echoes what former American enemies have done against U.S. soldiers, but also reflects what we saw with many of the Bush policies post-9/11. And in fact, the way I came to this subject was because I was working on one case in particular on behalf of Jose Padilla. Some folks might remember he was a U.S. citizen held in military custody where he was tortured and interrogated. And one of the things that he complained about the most was the just crushing isolation that he experienced while he was in military custody. Well, he eventually was released to the criminal justice system where he was tried, convicted, and is now in nearly identical conditions, not undergoing interrogation anymore, but still under the same crushing isolation at a federal penitentiary called Florence ADX in Colorado. The express purpose of the U.S. policies there in the counterterrorism context were to dehumanize and to render the subject utterly helpless. It was called learned helplessness, was in fact the phrase used by those who constructed this interrogation method. So when we think about how this policy plays out over the many states and in the many, many prisons and jails where it's used, I think that that's a useful and relevant backdrop. So we recently completed a survey of the policies regarding the use of administrative segregation, which is a form of separation of prisoners who have been sentenced. And there are basically several different types of segregation used in the prison system. Some are called punitive or disciplinary, others are called protective, and some are called administrative. We focused on administrative because that is the broadest category, and typically people are sent to administrative segregation for indefinite terms. And so this is often where you see people languishing for years, if not decades. So we did a study of 47 states and the Federal Bureau of Prisons. We spent a lot of time just poring over the policies to see what we might find out. The clear trend that we saw was that they all sort of relied on a very broad purpose. So the criteria for why you could be placed were extremely broad. Generally, there was language regarding the safety of staff and inmates and or the order of the institution. I want to pause here to say that there is no doubt that horribly violent things happen in prisons all the time. And so I think if we're to talk about the use of isolation in prison, we need to really be mindful of the very real challenges that both prisoners, staff, and administrators face, and the sort of how the violence is created, how it reproduces itself, I think are things that perhaps we can get into later in the conversation, and whether isolation is in fact a useful intervention is an altogether different issue. But there's no question that safety is an issue in prison, and safety is in fact what at least on paper drives the use of isolation. Now, the difference and the line between safety and control is a whole other question and something we might get back to later. Because I think from looking at policy after policy, we just were really struck at how broad they were and how an inmate would really have no basis to understand what would land them in indefinite isolation. And then the other general trend that we saw that was just, as one would expect, where there's broad criteria, there's just incredible discretion and a lack of predictability about who's going to end up in administrative segregation and why. And this has been borne out in states that have chosen to look at closely at their own populations in long-term segregation. Every state that has undertaken that task has ultimately decided to reduce their populations in long-term segregation by at least 50%, often 90%. And the reason is because oftentimes when you look at it in practice, people are being sent to segregation not because they're truly dangerous, but because perhaps they're troublemakers or the prison doesn't know what else to do with them. In terms of our other findings, we found that really the procedures varied greatly. You know, a lawyerly response to the issue of segregation might be to say, well, one should add more process, be sure that the right people are looking, you know, conducting robust reviews. Our sense is that the jurisdictions varied widely. My hunch is that additional procedures could make some difference, but unless we wrestle with the much more basic question of why, when and why should this practice ever be allowed, all the procedures in the world aren't going to do much good. There was also a great deal of variation about what happens to people once they get into long-term segregation. Some jurisdictions, such as Washington, are now making an effort, I think a genuine effort, to try to think of what types of programming will assist those who do have severe behavioral or other issues and who have proven to be violent continually when they're in general population or less secure settings. I'm no mental health expert, so there's certainly questions to be considered about when and if mental health treatment can really be appropriately provided in that type of extremely controlled setting. I guess I'll leave it there, except to note that, you know, we just looked at the policies, and the policies and the practice, of course, can be widely divergent. And so what we don't know is far more striking than what we do know. We don't know who is in segregation. We don't know the demographics. We don't know why they're there. We don't know how long they're there. And let alone we don't know even to the extent that segregation is being used modestly by a particular jurisdiction for perceived safety issues, we have no idea whether or not it works. And there's lots of reasons to think, in fact, that it might aggravate people who have violent tendencies. And so I hope that we are at the cusp of the use of segregation being, if not completely obliterated, then certainly decreased significantly.
If I could just add to that, actually, in those states where there has been a significant reduction in solitary confinement, the use of solitary confinement, there's very often concern that are raised by the Department of Corrections that doing so is going to increase the violence, is going to increase the danger to the prison staff, and the findings are strikingly the opposite, that there is no increase in violence, and often there is actually a decrease in the violence that you see in those prisons. Because these types of settings, this whole procedure with solitary confinement, first of all, the people who become subject to it are so typically people who have mental health problems, and that's a real strong basis for why they're doing what they're doing. But if you take the state of Maine, where Joe Ponte, who's the commissioner, really took a very brave step of severely reducing the use of solitary confinement. It's now, I think, about 25% of what it was before. There has been no increase in violence, and in fact, there is some evidence of decrease in violence as a result.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the effects of prisons and prison conditions. Philip Zimbardo, to bring you back in.
Yeah, I just wanted to say two things. One, of course, is that many of the people in solitary confinement are there, in quote, because they're seen as troublemakers from the point of view of the guards or systems. The other population of people in the solitary are informants, snitches, who are put there for their protection. And in fact, I was involved in the San Quentin Six murder case following up with George Jackson. And the first thing the prisoners did when solitary confinement was, when it was open, when George Jackson came down with the keys, is they killed, they massacred the informants. So again, as I said, security is an issue, but everything we know about the importance of social contact, of social connection, says that anything that isolates us from other people in the human condition is detrimental to mental health. And the longer people are isolated, the more devastating it becomes, and the harder it is for them ever to really adjust. Certainly harder it is to ever adjust to being back in main society.
With these lessons, can we start to think about an alternative system that actually brings out more positive social behavior? Philip Zimbardo, you're the person who has really kind of taken the lead on how the system makes the person. How do you see a potential system for real rehabilitation?
One simple refocusing is, suppose when prisoners are given a jail term, when prisoners exhibit good behavior, that the guards get credit for it. And the shorter the time a prisoner spends in prison, the guards get rewarded, get salary bonuses. So you change now the incentive of the guards to be supportive, to be helpful, to be informative to prisoners, rather than to be indifferent to dehumanize them. There's no incentive for guards to treat a prisoner well. There's every incentive to get them out of their face, put them in solitary confinement indefinitely. Our maximum security prisons, as in Pelican Bay, have prisoners in there for 23 hours a day and for months and months, maybe even longer. And they mimic what's happened at Guantanamo Bay, only these are not terrorists. These are not people who threaten the well-being of America. These are people who've broken a law at some point, were sent by jury to prison, but not to the nightmare that is there. So we need to say one way to change the prison is we have to really think in terms of systemic changes, not cosmetic changes, a little program in this prison or that. How do we make it so that the guards actively work to help prisoners get out of prison rather than keep them in prison as long as possible, because that's their breadbasket?
Stuart Grassian?
Yes. You know, I'm just reminded of cases I've been involved in. There's one in particular that stands out in my mind. The settlement of the class action lawsuit required that the prison recognize that a lot of the behaviors that were causing the inmates to end up in solitary confinement were, in fact, manifestations of mental illness. And that's very typical, by the way. I mean, that's not unusual that that would be the case. The net result was so good. I mean, it was so beneficial to all concerned, the corrections officers and, of course, the inmates as well, that, and this is the irony of it, that one of the named defendants, the head of OMH, tried to take credit for the changes. But he was a named defendant. It was under his watch that this was happening. Yet the result was so obviously good for all concerned. And I think that one needs to really empower mental health concepts in dealing with people in prison much more than is being done, much, much more. In fact, I was thinking, you know, in a psychiatric hospital, we always run case conferences, and those include all the staff. They include the non-really clinically trained staff. Well, why? It's because you have to give people a richer way of looking at behavior, because otherwise they feel helpless and they become angry. But if you give them a richer context, a richer way of thinking about it, it helps a lot, and people start really changing their behavior towards the inmate.
Hope Metcalf, what would you add in terms of the policy?
I would add something a little bit on the political end, and then let me see if I can get to the policy end. So the folks who lead these corrections departments, many of them actually, I think, would be allies. They are strapped for resources. They had probably the politically least popular departments in state government. They face enormous challenges. They are going to be the first to be fired should someone be released and something terrible happen. And there are actually people who are trying to make change from the inside, but they need a political constituency. They need people demanding that from the state legislators or governors who are going to be quick to turn a fast political buck by, you know, calling for more retributive policies. So I think identifying and lifting up the more progressive corrections leaders, whether it's the folks at the top or those in the middle, is a key aspect of long-term change here, as opposed to perhaps more divisive politics where we sort of, you know, make each other on each side into cartoons. And on the policy side, I completely agree with everything that's been said thus far. I think mental health is a key part of it. I also think the culture is essential, and it comes down to a fairly simple question, I think, that a leader of a corrections department said to me, which was, she said, you know, really at the end of the day, the question is, are we afraid of this person? Or are we just mad at them? Because if we're afraid of them, then we should be dealing with them in a particular way that's going to implicate security, to treat them safely, to figure out what works, to be creative, to integrate mental health approaches, et cetera. But if we're just mad at them and sort of putting them in the troublemaker category, then this is a really counterproductive policy.
Thank you, Stuart Grassian, Hope Metcalf, Philip Zimbardo. Really appreciate your work. Really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Hope Metcalf is the Associate Research Scholar in Law and Director of the Arthur Lyman Public Interest Program. She teaches a clinic on prisoners' rights in the United States and is co-author of the reports Administrative Segregation, Degrees of Isolation and Incarceration, A National Overview of State and Federal Correctional Policies, and Gideon at Guantanamo, Democratic and Despotic Detention. Philip Zimbardo is Professor Emeritus of Psychology at Stanford University and currently on the core faculty of Palo Alto University. He has authored more than 50 books, including The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil, and The Psychology of Attitude Change and Social Influence. Stuart Grassian is a psychiatrist and a former faculty member at Harvard Medical School. He is the author of Psychiatric Effects of Solitary Confinement and The Effects of Sensory Deprivation in Psychiatric Seclusion and Solitary Confinement. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to the Scholar Circle team who makes this show possible, Ankine Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Joe Pinto. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed a part of the show, you can go back either to the kpfk.org audio archives, or you can go to scholarcircle.org. You can hear us on iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can follow me at @armudian.